author, naturalist, Joel Greenberg. Joel, good morning.
Well, it's quite the day out there, and you've commented that people ought to experience adverse weather. When you'll remember, for us old guys, when it was 25 below zero one day, decades ago, I went out and did a little birding and actually saw a robin. I agree. You should at least sample it.
Yeah. An email from Dan Costa over at Vern Goer's greenhouse in Hinsdale. He says he was just watching his resident rabbit digging in the snow under the bird feeder and eating the fallen bird seed. He seemed to know the seed was there.
We had a Cooper's hawk a couple days ago right next to our feeder. And so bird feeding, you know, you put out seeds to feed the birds. Well, now you track the birds to feed the Cooper's hawk. So everybody enjoys this.
Well, okay, you're an expert at this because you are a birder. Is there such a thing as a master birder?
Not in the way that there's a master gardener or master naturalist. No, not a formal program.
There should be. You know, because you would qualify. Let's get some information out before we talk about your book.
Okay.
About what folks should be doing with this huge snowpack. Is this a time to feed birds, or can they manage by themselves?
Well, I mean, I think birds can manage by themselves. There's probably some mortality as a consequence. I mean, this is part of their evolutionary history. On the other hand, you know, you provide food for them, and it certainly, you know, would certainly help those birds that have access to your feeder. Some birds, hummingbirds, have lingered into the winter, and clearly, you know, they wouldn't survive if it weren't for the handout of perpetually warmed sugar water. So, yeah, and also it's, you know, you're stuck in your house on a day like today. Sing something alive, and even if they're just house sparrows or starlings, these ubiquitous aliens of the ruderal world, it's kind of neat to see something alive. Or the squirrel. We have two kinds of squirrels. The fox squirrels are being driven out by the grays. So the fox ate first, and then later the grays came. And so for me, seeing wildlife, you know, is pretty neat when you're limited as to where you can go.
I was in reading A Feathered River Across the Sky. I noticed that you refer to what used to be called English sparrows. They're not called that anymore?
No. The American Ornithologist Union formalizes bird names. And for quite a while now, they've been called house sparrows. There's a trend away from proper nouns, and it's been called house sparrow quite a bit now.
Blame somebody, so if we can blame the English, that's always a good thing.
There used to be a bird called the English storm petrel, or the British storm petrel. Most of them nested in Ireland, and as you can imagine, Ireland was really annoyed that this bird nested mostly in their borders. Was given the enemy's name, as it were.
Well, you know, several years ago, I put out a bird feeder in the backyard for the winter, and I thought, oh, this is going to be fun. I'm going to get to watch all kinds of different birds over the winter and enjoy their presence in my yard, see some nature. And it was like 12 billion house sparrows showed up and about, you know, three squirrels and a few pigeons. And that's what I got.
Over time, you'd probably get more variety.
But here's the other problem with that, is that if you put it over your garden in the spring, you're getting all kinds of stuff that is sprouting underneath it. How do you defeat that?
Well, that's a good... That happened with passenger pigeons.
Well, that's actually, that might be our transition into your new book. Joel Greenberg has penned an excellent book called A Feathered River Across the Sky, The Passenger Pigeon's Flight to Extinction. Now, I'm looking at Facebook right now, and a fellow named Don Gorney, does it sound familiar?
My good friend from Indianapolis.
Who writes, "Someone please call in and ask if it is true that passenger pigeons went extinct because of the demand for pigeon on a stick at the 1893 Chicago World's Fair?
And the answer is no.
No.
Okay.
I knew it.
Those are easy ones, Donna.
We didn't eat them.
They did become extinct because they did become a commodity, and there was a market and an industry that exploited these birds relentlessly. There were people anywhere from 500 to 2,500, the literature varies, who did nothing, Mike, but chase the birds
yes.
wherever they were.
And this is documented in your book. And to answer Lisa's questions, you just did, which is to say, yes, Lisa, people did hunt the bird and ate it relentlessly, but it wasn't. By 1893, the bird was gone. All right. There were a few extant, but there wasn't going to be any passenger pigeon on a stick at the 1893 World's Fair.
Well, I remember the anniversary from last year, and it's so sad.
It is. It's a horrifically sad story. And so the place we start. All right. Here's where I want to start with this, because this is reading your book. This is the question me. In reading it and since reading it, and it continues to bother me, which is, why didn't I know about this before you first appeared on this program? I mean, an animal that existed in the billions that would take days for flocks to fly overhead, would block out the sun, would completely devastate forests because of the birds landing and dropping their waste products. Why is this not drummed and drilled into kids' heads in school?
You know, I can't answer that. If I had the resources and I thought about it, it would have been interesting to do a poll to find out how many people know what the passenger pigeon is. I mean, obviously, a lot of the people I hang out with, you know, if you're interested in birds or natural history or even cult, you know, human history, people, if you ask most people, sometimes I've been surprised, but people might say, yes, I know what a passenger pigeon is, and then you ask them what it is, and they say it's a bird that delivered messages during the war. Well, that's Columbolivia. That's the common rock pigeon, the pigeon you see in the city. It's not this bird indigenous to the eastern half of the United States and Canada that, as you said, was the world's most abundant bird, and we wiped it out. Hundreds, you know, we don't know exactly how many, but there were surely hundreds of millions of them, you know, in the 1860s and early 70s. And, you know, 40 years later, they were gone. And so I don't know why we don't. I mean, I guess as a society, we tend to focus, as I say, you know, I'm interested in things that are more enduring than the Kardashian wedding. You know, I mean, we tend to, you know, focus on all the, you know, human-oriented stuff, so...
Yeah, well, you know, and I think the point is that part of that human-oriented stuff is we're interested who was in the White House and a couple of other things. And we lose the background. For instance, okay, I'll give you an example of how we lose that. And Kathleen Thompson... my partner and as you know, has a website called onehistory.org. And she tells on that, she's written several books about history and done, picture history, photo history, photojournalism. And she and her partner, Mac Austin, concentrate on the underreported parts of history and peoples in history, namely minorities, women, and children. They're all part of our history. They were there when George Washington was there and Abraham Lincoln and the Civil War was going on and other things were happening, but they're completely underreported.
In part because I suspect that population didn't leave much of a written record. I mean, there's just a lot.
Not as much, but there is some written record.
Sure.
And it's been summarily ignored. Basically, by the power structure, which is male and white, as we know, and has been for a long, long time. Now, how that extends to our natural world, you know, including passenger pigeon, bison, and the other animals that were extirpated or almost extirpated. 19th century, a particularly brutal time?
It was. And basically what you had, I mean, you had things going on. You had, obviously, the United States population just you know, growing tremendously. You had new technologies, and with respect to game, the passenger pigeon, other bison, you had railroads, you had telegraphs, which meant that you could transport things killed in remote areas to big cities to the east relatively easily. You had telegraph so that the hunters knew exactly, and let's just focus on the pigeons. The pigeons, I mean, you know, a roost, say 10,000 birds landed in some part of western Missouri, would take quite a while to know. But now the telegraph operators were specifically instructed to spread the word. So in no time, you had these professional hunters, you had the locals killing them, whereas, you know, it used to be possible they'd have a respite for a while. So anywhere they might be, basically, became accessible to this industry. And that was, North American wildlife paid a huge price. The Eskimo curlew was another bird, not as spectacular in numbers as the pigeon, but that is almost certainly extinct too, and the numbers plummeted when they were part of the market. Other birds were saved. Egrets and terns were used. They were converted into hat ornaments. And so the numbers, so the technology and the growth of the population. Two things you said earlier, if I can just, one is you said it's a sad story, and it is, if you end it on September 1st, 1914, when Martha died, but
Martha was the final passenger pigeon.
She was. She was born in Chicago, sent to the Cincinnati Zoo in 1902, and lived until September of 1914, the second to the last bird who shared a cage with her, named George. The thought is the zoo named these two birds after the Washingtons.
Brilliant.
He died like 1911, and so she was the last one for several years. But what that decimation of wildlife, the pigeon being one of the biggest things, bison were another, led first environmental movement. And that in turn led to the passage of the Lacey Act, which was the first federal law to protect birds, and then ultimately the Migratory Bird Act, which the Supreme Court in 1920, Missouri, that it was within federal jurisdiction to regulate on the taking of migratory birds. And that's sort of another point about the 19th century. There was no federal involvement in migratory birds. I mean, people, if you want to save the commons, you remember Garrett Hardin's book, Tragedy of the Commons, that was written in the 70s. Who's going to protect the air, the water, migrating birds? The only entity that can do that is government, and federal government, or, you know, that's why in the seas today that are being pillaged by, you know, by fishing in international waters, no country has control of it. So you need a sovereign that is willing to interject itself into protecting the commons. And so another aspect of what happened in the 19th century.
Yeah, but that's fraught with danger, too, because you know the way this country works, and states' rights are a powerful force. And every time you bring in states' rights, it's environmentalism for the most part, it seems to me.
Well, that's why the bigger the jurisdiction, i.e. the federal government, I mean, the Endangered Species Act, which has been an amazing thing, a wonderful thing, is under, but, you know, the first, it's often the case, I mean, Connecticut was one of the first states to protect birds. Illinois had a very strong bird protection act. So eventually, That was in the 1890s, and eventually, you know, in the early 20th century, the federal government took it upon itself to say, you know, we have jurisdiction over these migratory birds.
As you say, had to do with the passenger pigeon because, as you so well put it in your book, A Feathered River Across the Sky, people seem to be a little dumbfounded that the bird was gone because in the 1860s, billions, and then, of course, in when it disappeared, folks were making all kinds. They had all kinds of theories about what had happened. Well, they flew to South America. and you know, those. It occurs to me that those people today would be watching Fox News.
Well, the climate denial. Some of them, Mike, that's really perceptive of you because it struck me too that some of the language. You know, oh, people are going to lose their jobs if we do this. And, you know, God gave it here for us to use. And, oh, don't worry, there's still plenty of fuel and there's plenty of water.
And they were saying that in the 70s and 80s. Don't worry, there's plenty of birds. You could never possibly kill them all off. And by the way, I should remind people, we're talking to Joel Greenberg, author of A Feathered River Across the Sky, The Passenger Pigeon's Flight to Extinction. As you mentioned, that as the bird was in decline, there was complete denial. All that sound familiar to you here in the 21st century?
It does. And the other thing that made it easier, I mean, A, there wasn't the communication back in you know, the 1800s. Also, because the bird flocked, you know, you could say truthfully as late as 1882 that maybe 3 million, 4 million birds were nesting in Wisconsin. See, there's plenty of them. The point is, 4 years before, there were 50 million that nested in a place. So they did aggregate often. I mean, they nested in other ways, too. But so the point is that there would be, at any given point, maybe a place where somebody could say, oh, there were lots of them. And the industry also made up, oh, they nested four times a year, and they had two eggs in a nest. They nested, produced one egg. So they actually manufactured aspects of the bird's life history specifically to allay concerns that the birds were disappearing.
Do we call that today disinformation? And and it is rampant in our society.
It absolutely is.
And it's also funded by billions of dollars.
Yeah, which back then, obviously it wasn't by that, you know, kind of resources. So yeah, no, absolutely. There. I mean, to me, that's why, you know, somebody might say, okay, who cares about something that's been extinct for 100 years? But the lesson is, you know, as a cautionary tale to the proposition that no matter how abundant something is, we can lose it if we're not careful. And now there's over 7 billion of us on this planet, hundreds of millions living at middle class, you know, I mean, consuming a lot more than they did back then. So, you know, whatever it is, it could be fuel, it could be water, or something alive. It's an important message that you use things. It could be your own family checking account. I mean, it's finite, you know. You have to treat it carefully or you're going to get in trouble.
Well, one of my favorite words at the moment is stewardship. One of the superior, intelligent species on the planet have a responsibility.
I use that in air quotes, intelligent, responsible species.
I'm using it in the sense of it is our responsibility because we know better. We should know better.
We should.
And ignorance is not bliss. Ignorance will lead to things like the extinction of species.
Well, and as Joel points out in the book, we are already the beginning or the middle of the sixth great extinction on the planet. And it makes me wonder, Joel, do you see the starting point as the 19th century and the destruction of so many species once our technology, you know, basically what a lot of it had to do, as you said, railroad, communication, and guns. The sophistication of our guns could take out billions and billions and billions of birds. So do you see that as the starting point for the sixth great extinction?
Well, I mean, one of the things that I address, I mean, there are my friend David Blockstein, an ornithologist, refers to them as the four horsemen of extinction. So, you know, one is direct take. That's what happened to the passenger pigeon largely. In this country, you know, more or less that's under control, more or less. You know, there are laws, and you can do only so much. There's three other things. There's habitat loss, which is rampant. There is pollution, you know, which is rampant and which, you know, ultimately is creating climate change. And the fourth one is, and this comes pretty close to home, too, I mean, our introduced species. And that might include letting your cat wander out, you know. I mean, cats kill hundreds of millions of birds a year, if not a billion, too. So the point is that there are all kinds of threats. I mean, and the second great environmental movement, you know, spawned arguably by Silent Spring, her consummation of biodiversity, the web of life out there netting and shooting birds, you know, by the hundreds of thousands, it was because of pollution. So the point is that as society is becoming more complex, there are more and arguably even more insidious, you know, things we're doing that are reducing the number share of the planet. And, you know, for some of us, that's not a good thing.
And as you mentioned in here, no, it's not a good thing. You also mentioned something that I talk about, and that's the metaphor of the airplane and removing rivet by rivet from a plane that's flying. And which is the species that we remove where the rest of it comes tumbling down?
Exactly.
And who is it that that came up with that idea?
Well, Paul Ehrlich wrote about it. Paul and Ann Ehrlich. He wrote the Population Bomb. He's at Stanford. I don't know if he came up with it. Perhaps he did, but I learned about it through his wonderful book called Extinction that he and Ann wrote in 1983, I think. So, yeah, I mean, eventually, you know, and it's hard to know, you know, exactly what that is going to be or when. But, you know, I think it is a powerful, you know, metaphor. And, I mean, we could see it on, we maybe have talked about, you know, flooding. I mean, you change the vegetation. I mean, you change the surface of the land so that it no longer can absorb water. That water is going to go somewhere, and it may settle in the low point in your backyard or basement. You know, so even here in the Midwest, we can see the effects of removing, you know, simplifying the web of life.
We're talking to Joel Greenberg, the author of the excellent book, A Feathered River Across the Sky, The Passenger Pigeon's Flight to Extinction. I'm not going to bust you about the whole Diane Rehm show coming this Tuesday. Oh, wait, I guess I just did, didn't I?
No radio station is local anymore.
That's right. I've got my folks listening in California and on the East Coast and all over the world in Germany. They all want to buy the book. So, you know, you better let all your friends know when you're going to be on my program.
I try to, make amends, Mike.
and you didn't even show up today. No, I'm giving you a pass on that one. Yes. What time are you going to be on Diane's show on Tuesday?
Okay, I'm going to be on there at 10 a.m. Central Time.
Okay.
Let me say one other little Peggy note about Nature Museum, and Steve Sullivan and I were on your show back when talking about the Project Passenger Pigeon. They've been very involved, very helpful in spreading the word on this broader Project Passenger Pigeon, of which my book is one part. They're going to hold a reception for me on February 23rd, Thursday, at 5:30. The talk starts at 6. And so I would encourage anybody who happens to be at the Notabart vicinity, you know, which is at Cannon Drive and just north of Fullerton, to attend. One of the special guests is going to be Big Blue, the last wild passenger pigeon for which there is an extant specimen. I discovered this in my research. Big Blue is the motto of Millikan University, which is where the bird is. And the ornithologist from Millikan is going to drive. I think he's said you were going to come, and I'm thrilled that you will be. I should also say one other thing. There's a movie, and David Mrazek, the director, and I were on Mike's show. So Mike is going to be the voice of John Audubon in our documentary, and that's moving ahead. Should be ready in April, if not even before. So we're thrilled, Mike, with your help and enthusiasm for this project.
Well, I am enthusiastic about it. I think it's, and other people have said, it's a cautionary tale. We need to be paying attention to this, and the 100th anniversary is a great time to do that. We're talking to Joel Greenberg. You've been on the program before talking about Project Passenger Pigeon, and explain exactly what Project Passenger Pigeon is.
This is an attempt to use this anniversary to let people know about it, to try to overcome the ignorance about it that you addressed, Mike, in some comments earlier. We want people to know about what happened to the bird and to divine the lessons, the messages from that story that are still relevant today. We have a website, passengerpigeon.org. We have over 160 organizations. The book is a major part of it. The movie is a major part of it. We're really fortunate. We're getting some really good press. Bird Watching Magazine is going to have an article come out next week. Audubon Magazine and Orion, more general environmental publications, are going to do stories. And The New Yorker, I was just thrilled. I mean, did a 3 or 4 page article. New York Review of Books, The Wall Street Journal, McLean publication. So we basically, and then there's going to be exhibits. Peggy Notabart is going to have an exhibit on extinction. There's others across the country, even on the West Coast. I mean, places far removed from where there were passenger pigeons. A host of programming. Anthony Philip Heinrich was a 19th century composer who wrote a symphony about passenger pigeons. It appears likely that at least two orchestras, including the University of Wisconsin-Madison, is going to perform it. Brushwood Center, which used to be Friends of Ryerson in Riverwoods. And Mike, if you've never been there, we'll have to go, because Sophie Twitchell, the director, they do a lot of things with art and conservation, trying to get people engaged in these questions through through art. And so there's going to be an amazing exhibition in May called Moving Targets, and there's going to be just a host of things like that. And so I'm really pleased we planted these eight.
Several things I want to mention, and I'm glad I just got an email, because I meant to mention this, because I know this is one of those questions that you're going to get every time you get interviewed about this. And that is, Clarissa writes to me, "Hi, Mike, scientists are definitely talking about bringing the passenger pigeon back. And this is their first candidate. On the list of candidates, there's the mammoth, as well. Western scientists, as she writes, considered it inappropriate to try the same with the Neanderthal. But Chinese scientists might not give a darn." Well, I don't know if that's true or not. Dinosaurs are not yet on the list, but she says a raptor. What, the Velociraptor, whatever.
Oh, yeah, okay.
But might make a pretty awesome hunting dog. But that's something that I'm sure everybody's going to ask you, because it's the latest and the greatest story, which is, ooh, we're going to clone passenger pigeons and bring them back. First, what do you think about the possibility of that happen? Second, what do you think about it?
Well, I've been involved the the Long Now Foundation, which is Stuart Brand and Ryan Phelan's organization. They look at issues far into the future. They invited me to a meeting in Boston they were having on it. There are a number of candidates. My friend Ben Novak is working on passenger pigeons, a mammoth, something called the thylacine, the Australian wolf from Tasmania. So this isn't exactly cloning, and genetics isn't my strong suit. But you take DNA. So with passenger pigeons, they've had access to large 1,500 to 2,000 dead passenger pigeons in museums in the world. And so they've been extracting DNA. And the idea is, again, not really cloning. You then put that DNA into a close living relative, which in the case of the passenger pigeon, there's a genus of New World pigeons, which includes the band-tailed and the white crown. So they're using band-tails. And what you do is it's like you take a band-tailed chassis, you change it by introducing this DNA from passenger pigeons. Is it people much more expert in that than I think it can be done? I mean, I think that even if you were to create some small number of these things, mostly passenger pigeon maybe, but if you introduce them in the wild, they look so much like mourning doves, they would be shot. So you'd have to create more mourning doves are shot, I believe, than any other game bird. So, you know, there's all kinds of social problems. So there's that. You would have to create a non-migratory population. You certainly could never replicate the spectacle of what, you know, it was like when the sky at a time in the 19th century. Whether you want to or not, it's another story, but you certainly, you know, aren't going to be able to do that. So they might be able to create these. I mean, smart, knowledgeable people think they can. Everyone doesn't agree. So it's, I guess in my mind, it's sort of an open question. But one of the things that I find, Mike, really what does resonate with me is that those who do know the story, and you're right, more don't than do, but those who do are moved by it. So I've, you know, spent 4 years writing this book and working on Project Passenger Pigeon. Ben Novak, the geneticist, is working on bringing him back. I mean, he's been intrigued by the story.
Yeah, I had somebody write to me this week and said, is he a relative? But I believe he spells his with a V.
It's different. And this is something, in the last, since 2011, there have been, at least that I know of, 4 novels that have been written with passenger pigeons as a major theme or setting for the books. So people, you know, are still moved by this story. It's a powerful story. And so, you know, just depending on your interest, it kind of manifests itself in different ways. So, I mean, I see that, the commonality of you know, what I'm doing and those who are trying to bring them back, you know.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think it's going to be a challenge. And the more success they have, in a way, I mean, as you proceed with the genetics, then you've got to deal, you know, with the politics and culture. I mean, then you start getting once you take it out of the lab, then you have to start dealing with people. And, you know, then it becomes a different story. But, you know, they're aware of it. And, it'll be interesting.
But you know, it does raise, and I'm going to get to a phone call. Mike is hanging on, and I appreciate that. We'll get to him in just a second. But it does raise an interesting question, moral question, I guess, ethical question as well, which is, people would say, well, how dare you tamper with nature and try to bring the bird back? Well, you tampered with nature in the first place by killing it off, okay?
Oops.
Yeah. You know, so how can you possibly draw a line? I don't see how you can.
Yeah, no, I mean, you know, that's an issue, and I think your response is a good one. You know, another issue out there is, if we think we can bring things back, would it make us any less careful? I mean, would...
No.
You know...
that's my answer, no.
Yeah.
In fact, Mike's got a comment on that. Mike, you're on the Mike Novak Show. Good morning. Good.
Yeah, I just thought I'd call and say, don't forget the plesiosaurs. You want to bring them back too, right?
Okay, sure.
They're not talking about dinosaurs. I mean, they're talking about,
we made extinct. I know. I was just joking.
You know. Yeah, no, but I mean the other, but you know, I mean, I don't. There's no. Is there dinosaur DNA even available? But I mean, if there is,
that would be.
There probably is. You know, we can find ways to get anybody's DNA these days. But what's your comment, Mike?
Well, you know, I started work at a country club back in 1983, working maintenance, and you know, there's a lot of glass on the building, and birds would run into the glass usually in the swing seasons. You know, spring and fall. And it wasn't unusual to go out and find a half dozen dead birds about every day. And when I retired from there in 2K8, just about, 6 years ago or so, it'd be about that many birds would hit the window in a season. which means the good news is less birds were hitting the window, but obviously the reason was because there are just less birds.
You might be right about that, and Joel actually writes about how many birds are killed by buildings.
Sure. It was never the crummy birds, you know, the grackles and the crows and sparrows or anything like that. It was always the finches and the wrens and the, you know, the real nice birds. I don't know. It's because the quality birds, I guess.
Yeah.
I think their eyes, the other birds, trash birds, I guess they could see the glass or something. I don't know what, but I don't think I saw any of those birds. Ever picked up any of those
any
birds.
Observations on that, Joel?
Well, yeah, I mean, apart from I don't make the distinction really with native birds, but it's migrants. I mean, a lot of these things fly at night. I mean, it's you are going to get, I mean, birds, some of the crows are permanent residents and they're diurnal. Grackles, I think, are diurnal. So you're you're getting a lot of nocturnal migrants. So that's one factor. And yeah, I mean, there is, in fact, if people are concerned about this, there's two different groups in Chicago that have monitoring during migration period. People are assigned, you know, buildings, and they go out and they rescue injured birds, and then they're rehabbed. Those that can be, the Field Museum, you know, has. People bring birds into them, and you know there's a huge number of species and, you know, individuals. So it is a important factor in bird mortality, undoubtedly.
Yeah, these birds you'd hear them, you know, hit. You'd hear them hit, you know, or I've even seen them fly into the window. So that was during the day. You say they hit at night too. Well, maybe but most of these were day hits, you know.
Yeah.
But another thing too, I notice I hardly ever see, like when I was a kid, it wasn't unusual, you know, back in the 50s, you know, like on a warm spring, like maybe late May, early June bugs just smack into the screens, you know, and you'd see them all over the ground. Now, I've noticed the decline in them, like back in the 80s and 90s, you know, and now I don't even know if they're still.
You know, what's disturbing about what you're saying, Mike, is exactly what Joel wrote in his book, which is there were people who would say, well, we seem to be noticing a decline in these birds, and other people say, oh, no, there's plenty because we just saw a grouping of several million, you know, in Ohio or in Pennsylvania or in Wisconsin. But the numbers were going down. We just didn't pay enough attention to it, and it does disturb me that you don't see June bugs and or crickets.
And those are quality insects. I mean, they're not crummy insects like flies.
you keep making these distinctions, Mike, between
Mike Diptera, the fly. I mean, we try to eradicate those things.
Yeah, well, Mike, listen, great contribution. I appreciate it. You have a wonderful Sunday, and stay warm, okay?
Take care now.
All right, bye-bye. We just got a couple of minutes left here, Joel, but he raises a good point. Mike's point is well taken, that, again, and I don't want to beat people over. Yeah, I do. I want to beat people over the head with this. There are some of us raising the alarm about certain things going on the planet. Most people want to have business as usual, and this is exactly where we were 150 years ago when the decline of the passenger pigeon started.
One difference now is these things are being monitored, and so, you know, bird populations, I'm sure insect populations. So we don't have the excuse of ignorance that they had in the 19th century when genuinely, you know, the passenger pigeon was never studied in the wild. So there's a lot we don't know. Now, we do know which species are declining, and at least at some level. So the importance that you do, and hopefully I do, we look at that and then hope to share it with a wider audience. But, you know, that as a society, you know, are monitoring these things. So that's something to the good. Could I promote one last little thing? Before
Go for it.
I now have my own website, so I just wanted to share that.
It's already on my page, but give us the URL.
Okay, well, geez, it's Joel Greenberg. Joel Greenberg's Natural History. And I guess I don't have the URL.
I do. It's joelrgreenberg.com. joelrgreenberg.com. Of course, you are the author of one of the classics, which is the A Natural History of the Chicago Region. And I urge people to pick up Feathered River Across the Sky, read this, and understand where we have been and where we might be going if we're not paying attention. I have information about Project Passenger Pigeon, and when the movie comes out later this year, we'll certainly talk about that. I even have the link to your New Yorker review if people want to take a look at that. So it's all on MikeNovak.net. Go to this week's show, and it's all there. Joel, it's been a pleasure talking to you, and we will do it again soon. Good luck on Diane Reams.
Thank you so much, Mike. Take good care.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye.